ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Good afternoon, Selena Green with you on this Tuesday. Well, coming up, Riverland growers who rely on the River Murray have some more clarity around how much water they can expect to be allocated this year. Some more on that in just a moment. And we'll take a look at what impact the Iran-Israel conflict is having on Australia's lamb market right now.
It's certainly heightened risk in that region at the moment, which for the companies that are operating in those areas, we'll be constantly monitoring and assessing the risks. But yeah, we have seen, you know, the big impacts of that sort of geopolitical event across the year.
More on that to come. If you want to get in touch with me today, my talkback number 1300 222 891, or the text line is 0467 922 891. Well, South Australian irrigators that rely on the River Murray are likely to get their full water entitlements in the coming financial year. The Murray-Darling Basin Authority announced a projected minimum opening allocation of 100% for 24-25 based on a water availability assessment. But with the allocation higher than usual, carryover of unused water from the previous year won't be allowed. Winky Almond and Wine grape grower Brett Rosenzweig says it'll give irrigators some peace of mind.
Oh, it's great to know that we've got 100% already now for this next season. That's one less pressure that we have to worry about for this next season. Also, if you're in the market for temporary water, I guess you know that there are going to be other people out there that have their 100% allocation, and you'll be able to trade from them.
Does it change your planning in terms of your own business at all, or does it just allow things to be a bit more clear-cut?
Certainly more clear-cut. So, you know, I think about the cost of water in terms of my overall business, so the 100% allocation doesn't quite come into that. Where the 100% allocation, it just means peace of mind that I know what I've got in my entitlement that I'm going to get access to this next season.
And I think the last time we spoke to you, it was regarding your transition from grapes or some grapes to almonds. Do water entitlements play any role in people like yourself transitioning from one variety to another, depending if, say, almonds are well known for being quite thirsty drinkers?
Well, yes, depending on how you grow your almonds. If you want to grow huge tonnages and large trees, then yes, the industry average is up there. Myself, I'm only banking on around about probably 10 to 11 megs a hectare for my almonds. So getting full allocation, I guess, yes, that does help with that decision making. But I guess because I don't have all of my permanent entitlement that I need for my business, I'm always keeping an eye on what's happening in terms of forward allocations, entitlement leases, and temporary water. So, which, you know, if you don't have all of your allocation, that's something that you should be doing on a year-by-year basis.
Winky Irrigator Brett Rosenzweig. Water Fire and Chief Executive Tom Rooney says irrigators have received full water allocations more than half of the time in the last two decades.
And this is the 11th time in the last 20 years that South Australian irrigators have received an opening allocation of 100%, and the 14th time that the state has received 100% allocation for growers for a full irrigation season.
What impact do you think that's going to have on irrigators? A bit of certainty around what they can expect coming downstream?
Yes, well, obviously it's been a very wet series of events that we've experienced recently on the Southern Connected area, and the reason why we've got this very high allocation is simply storages and the quantity of water which is in storage. Currently, about 3.6 million megalitres in active storage. And this is the third time in the last 20 years that we've actually seen that quantity of water in active storage. And hence the reason why the government's confident to allocate and provide this pre-knowledge or pre-allocation announcement out to the market that there will be 100% allocation.
In specific regard to the environment and environmental watering, should irrigators be using or receiving all of this water?
Well, there's a variety of different volumes of water. So there's over 1,800 gigalitres of water, or over 1.8 million megalitres of water, which is allocated to the state of South Australia as it is at the moment. Now, so that's the guaranteed flow, or supposed guaranteed flow that would come across the border. Irrigators at the moment have about a bit over 600,000 megalitres of that 1.8 million megalitres, and the rest of the water is divvied up into town water use, environmental flows, conveyancing flows. Plus as well, the Commonwealth Environmental Water Holder has also purchased a number of water rights directly from growers over the last 10 or so years. So they also own about 20-odd percent or 25% of all of the Class 3 water rights that are in the state. So I suppose currently at the moment, that allocation announcement is benefiting both the Commonwealth Environmental Water Holder and also benefiting environmental flows, as it also benefits irrigators with certainty as far as allocation is concerned.
For example, an irrigator doesn't use all of the water that is part of their entitlement. Can they sell it, or what happens to it if it isn't used within that yearly period?
Yeah, so irrigators can use up to 100% of their entitlement. That's what the allocation is. And if they do not use all of that water, they can sell it on the temporary market. They can also sell their entitlement themselves, so on the permanent market. What we normally see as a result of high allocations and high quantities of water in storages, we see lower prices in water values. And that is occurring at the moment. So we're seeing water values at actually about $20 a megalitre for temporary, which was probably 10 times that at the same period of time last year. And permanent water values at around $6,600 a megalitre. So we generally see a coinciding downwards pressure impact on pricing when there's lots of water around. And the reverse is true as well. When we see sort of lower quantities of water available when allocated, we generally see higher prices than in the markets. That's what we've seen in the past, but we're seeing sort of these lower pricing impacts associated with higher water volumes available at the moment in the South Australian market.
Tim Rooney there, Chief Executive of Waterfind, ending that story from Timu King. It is 12 minutes past 12. Well, Australian lamb producers have been caught up in the Israel-Iran conflict, with grounded flights in the Middle East halting an important trade market. Prices fell $20 to $40 for lighter lambs at the Bendigo sale yards, and processor Midfield Meats reported that it's had some flights of product on its way to the region turned around. Nutrien market analyst Olivia Agar explained what was going on.
The MLA Bendigo sale yard report showed that it really was a demand issue that was impacting the Monday market, with their reports that air freight into the Middle East has been disrupted by the latest Iran and Israel conflict. So in particular, they saw lighter weight, so the bag lamb market was $20 to $40 per head cheaper, and that some of the regular processing orders weren't operating. But if you look at some of the other segments in the market, they still performed really well. So heavy slaughter lambs into the US did better this week. The six to, you know, were a bit stronger as well. So it wasn't a total demand issue, and it really was that segment of the market heading to the Middle East that was disrupted.
Oh, there's a lot to unpack there. Can we start with the bag lamb market? What's the bag lamb market?
So it's the full, you know, the full lamb that typically heads towards the Middle East. And we really saw, you know, that market take off late last year. So if you look, you know, at the 3 months to date, even we've seen 23,000 tonnes of lamb exported from Australia to the Middle East for those first 3 months of this year. And compared to last year, that same period, we sent about 11,000 tonnes. So, you know, we've seen huge growth in that Middle Eastern market, and they really are a price market. Decline in value of lambs we saw over last year in particular really opened up the affordability of that product to the Middle Eastern market. So we've seen that since 2022, the Middle Eastern market share of Australian lambs grown from 13% to 20.6% last year, and then 27% for the first 3 months of 2024. So a really strong and important market for us at this time.
And when we say bag lamb, so it literally is a lighter carcass, sort of, you know, 18 kilos or less lamb, and the whole carcass is bagged and flown on a plane to the Middle East, and that's literally the market.
That's right. Yeah, that lighter sort of 18 to 19 kilo range is what suits that market and what they're after.
So the rockets fired and the drones fired from Iran towards Israel grounded a lot of flights in that area, and that's effectively ground that market to a halt for Australian producers. Is that what is being reflected through the sale yards?
It did temporarily. So Israel was forced to shut down their airspace for both domestic and international routes entirely on Saturday, and then they reopened it on Sunday morning. And the risk to aircraft in that region, it meant that Iraq, Jordan, Lebanon all chose to close their skies for that period, but they're all reopened their airspace now. So when that happened, you know, there are at least a dozen airlines that had to cancel or reroute their flights earlier in the week. But you know, Qatar, Emirates, a lot of them have managed to, you know, resume their suspended services and once the airspace began to reopen. But, you know, there are still warnings in place that there will be some flow-on impacts of the cancelled flights and disruption. But we should see that market return now that flights are moving through those areas again.
Yeah, so obviously it sounds like there's some good news there in terms of the market reopening up quite quickly after a fall this week at Bendigo, but does it show, I suppose, more widely the impacts that, say, conflict in the Middle East and what we've seen in Ukraine can have on Australian producers and their bottom lines?
Absolutely. You know, we see that disruptions to the global food supply chain will be extending well beyond this year in response to all the various geopolitical events that are happening. You know, there's a lot of volatility in the supply chain that comes with that and a lot of uncertainty as well. And there's certainly heightened risk in that region at the moment, which for the companies that are operating in those areas, we'll be constantly monitoring and assessing the risks. But yeah, we have seen, you know, the big impacts of that sort of geopolitical event across the year.
That's Olivia Agar there from Nutrien, and she was speaking to Warwick Long.
You're listening to Selena Green on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, a two-year-old heifer from the state's southeast has topped this year's elite Wagyu sale, selling for $130,000. Now, the sale was the highlight of last week's Australian Wagyu Association annual conference, which was held in Cairns. Matt McDonough is the CEO of the Wagyu Association, and Matt Brown asked him what made this particular heifer from Mayura Station so special.
It was the balance of breeding. So we've come from a position where we've had some genetics exported out of Japan 30 years ago. That were genetics from around 200 individuals. And at that time, they picked a range of unique individuals that were good for different traits. And it really took Australia probably 20 years just to amplify up the number of animals in the population here. And it's only the last 10 years we've really started to bring the optimal trait combinations together using genetics and the genomics tools that the AWA provides to its members to combine all of those best traits into one animal. And you're seeing that now with some of these elite genetics offerings like that heifer. You know, she's just supreme for several of the core traits that the Wagyu industry is looking to advance. And if we can move all of those traits forward together in an animal like that, she's worth a lot of money.
And she was bought by the Thomas family, who run a Wagyu operation in the United States. Now, how big of a deal is it for an overseas buyer to get involved?
It's not unusual. Certainly the last four or five conferences we've had, you know, at least 10% of the attendees at the conference internationals. So we have people all over the world coming into the conference here, and this year it's in Cairns. Yeah, with 650 delegates coming in to learn all about the Australian production industry. And part of that is, you know, accessing, you know, the expertise that sits in the room here. And there's an enormous amount of networking going on and the ability to get stuck in and buy some of our leading genetics at the Elite Wagyu Sale. And you know, 90% of the lots that are sold go, you know, stay in Australia. About 10% are probably sold internationally. You know, we had 100 bidders online last night from around the world trying to get stuck in, but they get out-competed mostly. And look, the opportunity is there to buy an animal like that heifer, get her into a reproduction centre into Australia and, you know, get some extremely high genetic merit embryos and genetic material to export back to the home country.
Right, so that's really her destiny, is it? She won't be flown back to the US?
No, no, she'll go into a centre somewhere in Australia.
Right.
And, yeah, they'll use her to get some embryos out of her and export those to the US. You know, this sale of one heifer to the Thomases from Santos Petronas, and they're beautiful people. You know, they've hosted Australian Waggy visitors in the USA, been extremely generous to us. So the sale to the Thomases at Santos Petronas is not unusual and really, really welcome.
It's been a big week for Mayura Station. It was also crowned Grand Champion in the Wagyu branded beef competition. Can you tell us a bit about this class one steak of its?
It well, firstly, I'll just congratulate Scott De Bruin and the team at Mayura Station. They're obviously having an absolute banger of a week. They're hitting it out of the park, winning the branded beef competition and having the highest sale lot in the elite Wagyu sale. So Scott's having an absolutely fantastic week, and I'm sure he celebrated well last night and the night before. So, but that piece of meat, it had two things which were really unique to it. The first thing, so it was a full blood entry. That's not unique. We had about 15 full blood entries. This entry was the largest ever eye muscle that we'd seen in a steak that had been, or in a piece of meat that had been submitted to the Wagyu brand of beef competition. And it was 62% unsaturated fat. So the fat in that piece of steak was about 60% IMF anyway, so extremely high amount of fine marbling in a very large ribeye. And the marbling in the ribeye was over 60% unsaturated fat. So when you cook that piece of meat and eat it, it's literally dissolving in your mouth. The temperature of the mouth is more than the fat needs to become liquid and dissolve. So you get an extremely juicy, rich experience, extremely tender. It's almost like the meat's bursting in your mouth when you eat it. It's an incredible experience. And that piece of meat was just unique. We'd seen nothing like it before.
How much would that steak cost, do you think?
Look, I don't think I can afford to buy it. I think you would be lucky to get that piece of steak in Australia. If you could, you know, probably around $200 a kilo is what it would be worth retail to buy that, but it's not likely you could buy it retail. It'll be sold in extremely high-class restaurants around the world. So by the time you amplify up that cost, it's, you know, probably about $500 a kilo or more if you wanted to buy and eat that steak in a restaurant, but you just probably couldn't buy it any other way.
And could you actually sit down and eat that much Wagyu with a 60% marbling?
Oh, heck no. No, yeah. You can't. So that's the interesting thing about Wagyu is on a steak that big, A, it's enormous, and B, you can't eat much of it. So typically what we're seeing with these really super high quality Wagyu offerings, like really big ribeyes, you know, enormous T-bones, 3 kilogram tomahawks, is you'll have a table of 10 people sitting around a hero dish, like a Wagyu tomahawk that's marble score 9+ off the charts. And that steak will be cooked. It will come out on a massive timber board and it will be sliced by the chef and the kitchen staff at a high-class restaurant into slices, and it's very much a share meal hero beef experience. It's a new way of experiencing steak, which I really enjoy, is the ability for everybody to sit around and share a meal together. It's just a great situation, and Wagyu slots right into that.
That is the CEO of the Wagyu Association, Matt McDonough. He was speaking there to Matt Brand. Later on in the program, you will hear from Mayura Station about their win. But if you want to clap your eyes on what this steak looks like and the marbling in it, it's quite extraordinary to look at. I'd be fascinated to know what it tastes like, but it sounds a bit like it's outside of my budget. Hop on the ABC Rural website, abc.net.au/rural.
The wait is over.
Where is Bluey?
For all new episodes of Bluey.
Ta-da!
There's the big 28-minute special for the wedding of the year.
Come on, Flower Girl!
And just when you thought it was safe.
Here come the granny!
No!
Everyone's favourite family in two brand new episodes.
Bad granny!
Cheeky kids.
All new Bluey. Streaming now. Always free, always entertaining on ABC iView.
It's 25 minutes past 12. It's time to head to the Weather Bureau. Dominic Panuccio is our forecaster today. Hi, Dominic.
Hi, Selena.
What's happening weather-wise? Much going on across the state?
Now, continuing with a fairly stable weather pattern, we have that high-pressure system centred south of the Bight, which continues to bring relatively settled conditions right across the state throughout this week. We did see some isolated light show activity about the southern York Peninsula and Fleurieu Peninsula and parts of the Adelaide Hills overnight and into this morning, which have largely cleared now, although there's still some showers down in the lower southeast persisting at the moment. The highest falls in the 24 hours to 9 a.m. today were just 1.4 of a millimetre at Red Creek, which is just to the southeast of Mount Barker, followed by 0.4 of a millimetre at Rosslyn Park in the Adelaide foothills and 0.4 also at Cape Jaffa on the southeast coast. And since 9 a.m. today, so far, we've had another 0.4 of a millimetre at Robe. So a few light showers about the place, but nothing significant. It was another cold night as well for many areas last night. We got temperatures dropping to around the 4 or 5 degree mark at locations in the southeast, Kangaroo Island and the Eyre Peninsula. And the coldest place for the state was 3.7 degrees at Coonawarra. And we can expect more cold mornings ahead for the next week, apart from probably Friday morning when we're expecting a bit more cloud to move up over the southern parts of the state. So, that'll prevent the temperature from dropping quite as low as what we have seen and what we're expecting on other days this week. Maximum temperatures today generally in the low 20s in the south, getting into the high 20s further north, and in the high teens in the south, lower southeast today. So just 19 for Mount Gambier, 25 for Renmark, 26 at Port Augusta, 21 for Port Lincoln, 22 at Whyalla, 28 at Coober Pedy, and 31 degrees at Moomba. Maximum temperature should be fairly similar throughout the week in the south, but slightly milder in the north by Friday. Top temperatures up there around 25 to 27 degrees on Friday, and a little warmer again for the weekend. There is, in terms of shower activity, there is a tail end of a front clipping the far southeast again overnight, Thursday into Friday. So we probably will see an increase in shower activity again for the lower southeast later on Thursday. And those showers will probably start pushing up the Gulf and along the back of the Mount Lofty Ranges on Friday, but clearing to a sunny weekend throughout the state. And probably sunny conditions continuing into early next week as well. So, looking like a fairly settled pattern. A few showers about, nothing significant though. Totals will probably be less than 3 millimetres. There might be some isolated falls up to about 5 millimetres or so, particularly in the lower southeast with those weak fronts moving across, Selena.
All right, thanks, Dominic. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Thanks, Selena. You too.
Dominic Panuccio there from the Bureau. All right, let's turn to the western inland parts of New South Wales and the forecast for tomorrow for the Upper Western District. Mostly sunny. There's a medium chance of showers in the northeast, but most likely from the late morning, and near zero chance of rain elsewhere. There is a chance of a thunderstorm in the northeastern part of the Upper Western District as well. Winds will be southeasterlies, 15 to 25 k's an hour, turning southerly in the early afternoon. Overnight temperatures between 12 and 16 degrees. Daytime temperatures forecast to reach around 30 degrees. For the lower western district, mostly sunny with light winds becoming southerlies, 15 to 25 k's an hour in the morning before becoming light in the evening. Overnight temperatures to around 10, daytime temperatures in the mid to high 20s. It is coming up to 12:30 here on the Country Hour. As promised, in this next half an hour, you'll hear from Mayura Station about their big win at the Wagyu Awards, and also we'll take a look at the ongoing inquiry into supermarket pricing and the way that supermarkets deal with their suppliers. It's been a fiery couple of days before that Senate hearing, including this morning when the head of Woolworths fronted up for questioning and to give evidence. You'll hear more on that very shortly.
You're listening to The Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Selena Green. Selena Green.
Hi there. Well, Woolworths, Woolies and Coles, they're being grilled over higher prices and rising profits during the cost of living crisis. This is all happening at a Senate inquiry in Canberra, which began yesterday but continues today as we speak, in fact. And it's been a fiery start, ahead of Woolies being threatened with possible contempt during his evidence this morning. I'll bring you up to speed on what's been going on in just a moment. And have you ever tried Wagyu? It's a pricey, mouth-watering cut of beef, and one South Australian Wagyu producer has sold one of its heifers for an eye-watering amount. What makes Wagyu so in demand?
When you take a Wagyu steak and you grill it, all that fat actually starts to dissipate and melt throughout the steak, leaving it beautiful and juicy and incredibly tender. Traditionally, when people think about the fat in steaks, they go to cook them, and the fat stays quite hard and it doesn't render down, whereas it does in Wagyu.
More on that to come. You'll meet the producer very, very shortly. But this is all coming after news headlines with Matt Coleman. Hello, Matt.
Hello, Selena. In the news this afternoon, a 48-year-old Mitchell Park woman has been arrested for allegedly having contraband at Yatala Prison in Adelaide's northern suburbs. Police conducted a search of the prison yesterday and allegedly found the woman with multiple prohibited items. She's expected to face the Adelaide Magistrates Court in June. A horse in the herd of Clydesdales affected by Ross River virus in Victor Harbour has died. 8 of the 9 horses at the tourist attraction contracted the virus. Horse Tram Authority General Manager Meg Whibley says services are continuing, but at a reduced level. And a Riverland producer has welcomed the projection of 100% water entitlement allocations by the Murray-Darling Basin Authority. The allocation is higher than usual, meaning carryover of unused allocated water from this year will not be allowed. Winky grape and almond grower Brett Rosenschwig says this forecast provides certainty and means a lot to primary producers like him. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thank you, Matt. Matt Coleman with those headlines. Well, the Senate hearing on supermarket pricing has been suspended this morning for a private meeting with outgoing Woolies Chief Executive Brad Banducci. That's while the committee decides if it will hold him in contempt. Bridget Herman has been following the hearing today.
In his opening statement, Brad Banducci said he welcomed the opportunity to appear.
And I hope I can help the committee understand the key drivers behind grocery inflation.
Greens Senator and Committee Chair Nick McKim outlined the evidence already heard by the committee, which is examining grocery prices and the power and influence of the supermarkets.
With all the evidence that we've received, how can you possibly deny that you are using your market dominance to do over farmers, to do over workers and to price gouge your shoppers?
Senator, as per our submission and my introductory comments, we disagree with that position.
Mr. Banducci denied the supermarket had been price gouging, but when it came to discussing the company's return on equity figures, the exchange got heated.
I'm asking you about return on equity, and I want to put this to you. Australia's banks, on average, make a return on equity of about 10%. Australia has the most profitable banking sector in the world. They are rapacious corporations that are making off like bandits, yet your company has a return on equity more than 2.5 times the average of Australia's banks. How can you possibly suggest that that is in the best interests of Australian shoppers when millions of Australians are skipping meals, having to dumpster dive to survive, and are being price gouged by your company?
Senator, with due respect, we look at the return on investment, which is 10%. If you looked at the share market return, it's a 10% return over the last 5 years, of which just over 3% is the return on dividends for our hard-working retail investors, many mums and dads in Australia. So that are the numbers we look at, and that's the performance.
Why won't you answer questions about return on equity, Mr. Banducci? It's because you don't like the story they tell. It's because you don't like what they show. That's right, isn't it? I mean, you know, you say you've got no problem understanding my questions, and yet you have repeatedly refused to answer the question here today in front of a Senate inquiry. Why won't you answer the question?
Senator, we focus on
the question is not what you focus on.
Dollar of investment in our business.
The question is not, Mr. Banducci, it's not, the question is not what you focus on. That is not what I am asking you. You can focus on whatever you like for the rest of your life. You're here before a Senate committee today. We're not interested in PR spin. We're not interested in you kind of bullshitting your way through this committee. We are interested in you answering the questions. Would you please answer this very simple question about the fact that your return on equity is more than 2.5 times the return on equity made by Australian banks, which are the most profitable banking corporations in the world?
Senator, the key metrics that judge returns are return on investment, or we call it return on funds employed, or return in the stock market, whether it's a capital appreciation or a dividend.
After a short break, the questioning returned to the issue of return on equity figures, but it didn't last long.
We're back in session in the Senate Select Committee on Supermarket Prices. Mr. Banducci, further to the advice I gave you just prior to the break, which is that it is open to the Senate to hold a witness in contempt for refusing to answer a legitimate question. I also feel compelled to advise you that a person failing to comply with a lawful order of a committee may be found, as I've said, to be in contempt of the Senate, and that in accordance with Section 7 of the Parliamentary Privileges Act 1987, subject to a penalty of up to 6 months' imprisonment or a fine of not exceeding $5,000. I want to make sure you're aware of those matters before we proceed any further. So in the light of that advice, can I just ask you again whether you accept that return on equity is an accepted measure of assessing a company's profitability?
Senator, as I've said, the way we measure our performance and profitability is our return on investment and total shareholder return. I recognise that financial institutions might have different ways they do things, but that's not the way we do it. This is the way we measure it, and it's the right way to measure it in the context of the industry we operate in.
I'm not asking you how you do it, Mr. Banducci. You're entitled to do whatever you like, but when you're before a Senate committee, my advice to you is to answer the questions that are put to you by me as chair of this committee. So leaving aside what your preferred measure is, leaving aside what you do in your board meetings or in your senior executive team meetings or within your corporation, leaving those matters aside, do you accept that ROE, return on equity, is a standard and accepted measure of the profitability of a company?
Senator, we measure return on investment, which we think is the right way of measuring profitability in a company. You put a dollar in, and what return do you get out? In our case, we get 10 cents out from the dollar we put in, and I don't think it's a coincidence that our total return TSR over the last 5 years is also 10%, which becomes a 3% dividend back to our hard-working retail shareholders.
Last chance, Mr. Banducci. Do you accept that return on equity is an accepted measure of the financial profitability of a company?
Senator, we measure return on investment. We think that is the right way to measure profitability in the grocery sector. I'm not commenting on financial services. I'm commenting on the sector that I operate in.
All right, the hearing is suspended. The committee will have a short private meeting.
Leah Weckert from Coles will appear later today.
Bridget Herman filing that report. Now, the hearing has since resumed after the committee suspended to have a short discussion. Woolies Chief Executive Brad Banducci has since resumed his evidence and agreed to take the question on return of equity metric on notice. But you can follow along on the ABC's live blog. Very interesting reading as the evidence continues today. So hop on the ABC News website to follow that along. And the codes governing the relationships between fresh food suppliers and retailers and price transparency were all in the spotlight at the inquiry yesterday. The Senate committee hearing also heard evidence about the idea of divestiture or the enforced breakup of the supermarket duopoly. Emily Doak filed this report from day one.
The Greens and Nationals have been pushing for laws that would allow a court to punish the supermarket giants by forcing them to sell off parts of their business if they were found to have abused market power. At the Senate committee hearing into supermarket pricing yesterday, ACCC Deputy Chairman Mick Keogh was repeatedly asked whether divestiture would result in more competition and lower food prices.
Where there is evidence that the existing market structure is so fundamentally dominated perhaps by a small number or a single player, and these available tools to try to bring some curbing to that power are ineffective or are not likely to work, it's conceivable that divestiture could be a tool that's employed, and it could be that it could force the creation of a more competitive market, which ultimately would, you expect, reduce prices. But the ACCC doesn't have policy on whether or not we support a divestiture power.
Bernie Smith from the union representing workers in the retail sector raised concerns about the potential impact on jobs, telling the hearing about his experience as a union organiser during the breakup of the Franklin's Group of supermarkets.
A lot of other members I knew who went to independent operators, unfortunately what we saw was a change that those people gradually left those businesses. Either they became family-run operations, which is understandable that more family worked in them, that's one thing, but we often saw a lot of them close. So one operator, the Aurora Group, for example, who picked up a number of those sites, they ended up closing the doors. All those members lost their jobs, and the government had to foot the bill, the FEG bill, for those employees when their entitlements weren't there either. So I think that on day one, it's right to say that divestiture may not necessarily cause job losses straight away. But what I saw post that was really quite sad in terms of our members and the experience that they had.
The ACCC is conducting its own inquiry, examining the pricing practices of the supermarkets and the relationship between wholesale, including farm gate, and retail prices. It plans to release an interim report by the end of August. Mr. Keogh told yesterday's Senate committee hearing that there's fundamental weaknesses in the food and grocery code, that it's not mandatory and therefore difficult to enforce, and that there's opportunities to opt out. He also told the hearing there's problems in the way the code deals with the relationships between fresh produce suppliers, wholesalers and retailers.
We've pointed out that a clause of the Food and Grocery Code, as it stands, exempts transactions that involve a wholesaler supplying the retailer. So that, in a sense, creates a situation where the Food and Grocery Code does not apply to the relationship between, for example, a retailer and a wholesale fresh produce supplier. So then the relationship between the wholesale fresh produce supplier and the grower is governed by the Horticulture Code, and the Horticulture Code has what's referred to as two pathways through it. One is an agency agreement and one's a merchant agreement. The dominance process used under that code is what's called a merchant agreement, which essentially means the grower consigns their produce to the wholesaler, and the wholesaler at some time in the future remits back to the grower what they say they've received as a market price less their margin, which is typically in the region of 15%. So that creates a pathway, if you like, where neither code is very effective.
He was also asked about the value of transparent pricing information throughout the supply chain.
Would you be supportive of mandatory price transparency measures, such as publishing of price data and how specials work, particularly in relation to shrinkflation?
We conducted an inquiry towards the end of the previous government called the Perishable Agricultural Goods Inquiry, which looked very specifically at the pricing challenges and the market challenges for a small range of perishable agricultural products. One of our recommendations there was that the government consider mechanisms whereby there could be greater transparency brought about in particular markets where, for example, concentration meant there was very asynchronous information available to parties on either side of a bargaining table.
Mr. Keogh was also asked about the particular challenges of competition in the supermarket sector in rural and remote Australia.
Distribution becomes quite costly, and there is perhaps a sustainable population that will support a supermarket, and below that it's very difficult. So it's not just limited to supermarkets. We see it in petrol retailing. We see it in a range of other sectors. And it is a particular challenge of Australia's geography with, you know, 90% something of the population living within 100 k's of the coast, and the rest pretty empty. So it is an abiding challenge, and it's something we are certainly going to look at as part of our inquiry.
As the Deputy Chair of the ACCC, Mick Keogh, giving evidence at the Senate committee hearing into supermarket pricing. We've got more coming up on this shortly and what was said at the hearing about Bunnings.
This is ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
You're with Selena Green. It's 14 minutes to one. Well, it's been a big week for Mayura Station in the southeast, winning the top award at last week's Australian Wagyu Association's annual conference, as well as having the highest selling heifer at the elite Wagyu sale. And now the only business ever to win the coveted Wagyu branded beef competition three times. The managing director of Mayura Station, Scott De Bruin, says decades of hard work have gone into creating a high quality product.
We've been breeding and producing full-blood Wagyu beef since 1998. And we've been running quite a specific R&D program on our beef quality since then. So 26 years, really, to get to this point.
And the third time you've won it, if I'm correct, were you obviously happy but surprised that you've gotten it for the first ones to get it for a third time?
So it's interesting. Mayura Station's only ever come first or second in this competition. And for the first 10 years running, I think I came second. And in recent times, we've been able to win it three times. So I'm very proud of the consistency of product that we produce. That's really what underpins the strength and the popularity of our brand.
And for those that might not be accustomed to eating Wagyu and they might hear over 60% of fat and think that that's a bad thing, but can you explain the difference between Wagyu fat and other cow's fat and how it enhances the taste?
Yeah, sure. So whilst it's not the same, if you think of Wagyu fat like an olive oil, if you like, so Wagyu fat actually has an incredibly low melting point. So when you take a Wagyu steak and you grill it, all that fat actually starts to dissipate and melt throughout the steak, leaving it beautiful and juicy and incredibly tender. Traditionally, when people think about the fat in steaks, they go to cook them and the fat stays quite hard and it doesn't render down, whereas it does in Wagyu. And the point that I was telling you before about the unsaturated fatty acids, so Wagyu actually has the most positive percentage of omega-3 and omega-6 fatty acids. So that fat is actually quite healthy for you, and your body actually needs a high percentage of this to function at a high level as well. And so Wagyu steaks actually have a higher percentage of these good fats and things like salmon that people regularly think of eating for their own health benefits.
You have a lot of products and all of them great, but the cream of the crop, where do your products normally end up, Scott?
So it's quite interesting, Elsie. So we're now, the majority of Mayura Station product is sold here in Australia. So while we've continued to grow our brand and increase our volume, we've been increasing the amount that stays here in Australia at the same time. So now some of the most premium steak restaurants that we supply are right here in Australia, in Sydney and Melbourne. We also supply into China, Hong Kong, Singapore, Taiwan, Malaysia, Saudi Arabia, Dubai and the United States of America.
And is that change just because you're growing and you've needed to find, you know, new markets within Australia, or is that Australia increasingly having an appetite for Wagyu?
It's the latter. So we're finding that the market for high-quality food produce in Australia is really starting to mature, and people are starting to really see the benefits in buying high-quality food products. And as a result, we've been able to continue to grow the market for Wagyu here in Australia.
And then the other exciting thing that happened last week was Mayura topping the list for the heifer sale. Were you expecting that?
I was hoping for it. Look, it was a wonderful result, and I think the reputation for Mayura has continued to grow. And we also, this year, we've annually been holding a Mayura station auction on property, selling some of our high-performance animals. This year we didn't do that, and the only animal we sold was at this elite auction. So I think that really did bolster the demand on this particular animal.
Yes, $130,000 for this particular heifer. What was so special about her?
So she was two things. One, she was bred by, or her sire was one of our leading sires in the market at the moment, so bull by the name of Mayura Quantum. And so that was quite a large influence. It also came with a straw of semen to breed the heifer with, which that straw of semen came from the bull that was the sire of the grand champion carcass in the Brenner Beef competition. So that certainly helped also.
As Managing Director of Mayura Station, Scott De Bruin, speaking with Elsie Adamo. And yes, it was $130,000 paid for a two-year-old heifer. If you want to have a look at it, but also the rather magnificent cut of Wagyu steak. It's really interesting to see the marbling of the fat in it. Hop on to abc.net.au/rural and you can read that story right now. Right now, let's go back to the Senate committee investigating supermarket pricing, which has been hearing evidence this week. And in its evidence yesterday, Australia's biggest hardware chain defended the way it deals with garden plant suppliers. In earlier evidence to the committee, one plant supplier said it had been encouraged by Bunnings to produce new plants, only to have orders dwindled or cancelled, and another spoke of being treated like a slave. Emily Doak has more.
Bunnings executives told the Senate committee that out of the 1,200-odd nurseries in Australia, it buys from 220 plant suppliers and that it values those relationships highly. Senator Nick McKim put the concerns raised about Bunnings' purchasing practices to the chain's ethical sourcing manager, Laura Gaspert.
The committee's heard quite a bit of evidence from suppliers of plants to Bunnings that's been very negative towards Bunnings. We've heard words to the effect that Bunnings treats suppliers like slaves and like numbers, not people. Given the risk to people for coming out and making those allegations publicly, do you think those are reasonable allegations in the context of how Bunnings treats its suppliers? Like, what's your response to those allegations?
I think both my colleague and myself shared a level of disappointment to hear about those supplier experiences. That absolutely has been my experience working for Bunnings. I've been with Bunnings for 5 years and I lead a team that engage directly with suppliers, and we have many channels that our suppliers can raise concerns. So suppliers can engage with us directly. There's a standing invitation by our executive team that all suppliers can reach out to them directly if they have any concerns. And then we also have a confidential whistleblower process. If suppliers would like to remain anonymous, that's an option for them as well.
Bunnings Greenlife category manager Belinda Rakers told the committee it provides weekly updates to suppliers about product performance, which helps guide their growing practices.
The trading terms doesn't outline any commitment of plants to be purchasing. But what we do with the suppliers is to provide all suppliers with weekly sell-through of those products in stores. As each one of our locations, we want each one to be relevant to the community in which it operates in. And it is a really customer-led offer. But the information that is provided to our suppliers helps them plan and forecast their growing.
Ms. Rakers told the committee that Bunnings only provides guarantees on orders when suppliers ask for it. And she said because supply agreements aren't exclusive, nurseries are free to sell to other retailers. Senator McKim asked about market share.
Look, just to be clear, even on your evidence about 25% of market share, that's not much short of the market share of either Coles or Woolworths, just so that we're clear here. I mean, I don't know what the market share is that you have. I hear your evidence, but that's a significant share of the market. And for some growers, you would make up a far greater percentage of what they provide into the sector. So wouldn't it be fair on your growers to include in your supplier agreements a commitment to purchase a certain amount of plants for them? Wouldn't that help with the viability of the sector?
Senator, we feel that the information that we provide weekly provides our suppliers with complete visibility of how their products are performing in the stores.
That's Bunnings Greenlife category manager Belinda Rakis, ending that report from Emily Doak. Well, as we heard, former suppliers of garden plants to Bunnings have told the Senate inquiry they were treated so badly by Bunnings, the resulting stress left them feeling like slaves. Bunnings, which is owned by ASX-listed conglomerate Wesfarmers, has denied the accusations and has urged suppliers to go directly to the company to report concerns. Well, Brockland's nursery owner, Karen Brock, made a submission to the inquiry and says the stress was so bad it threatened her marriage.
We were, my husband in particular, we was working for like 4:30 in the morning till 11 o'clock at night, 7 days a week, years on end. We didn't have a holiday for 12 years.
But why is that? Why was it so hard? I mean, you made a choice to supply Bunnings, but did you make money? You obviously kept going.
Well, it's a bit of a trick because you start off, everything's going really well, like any new marriage or relationship. And as the years go on, people change. And there was a really distinct cultural change around 2010 to 2012, in that time frame, where suddenly partnerships or working with you was not a keen focus. Now, unfortunately, by this stage, based on your previous experience, and yes, we were making some money at that stage, it wasn't a lot, but we had enough to hire, you know, 2 to 3 people to assist us. And then suddenly we were moving to robotic assistance because we couldn't get our prices up, but our cost of goods was going up and our infrastructure cost was rising. And then it got to the point where you're made to feel poorly because you don't dare ask for a price increase because we have to look after our customers. And we've got to keep the price low to make sure that the customers are getting the best product. And we're going to sell lots of your plants by doing this.
So over 13 years you were a supplier, how many price increases did they give you?
One.
Over 13 years. So in the end...
And that was in 2008.
Right. So were you selling plants at a loss?
We were actually looking at lean process management to the point where we were so lean that it was just the two of us and a robot who was doing all the plants. The trouble is you get to a point where we actually were just churning over money to pay for the bank loan for the robot, the bank loan for the greenhouses, your mortgage. So you were literally paying off your infrastructure to serve them, but you actually weren't paying yourself.
Karen Brock there, owner of Brocklands Nursery, and she was speaking to Fiona Breen about the stress of supplying plants to Bunnings. That Senate inquiry, it is ongoing. There's plenty more coming out of it today, and one of the best ways to keep across it is on the ABC News website, abc.net.au/news. It's 1:02, almost time for me to hand over to Nikolai Bailharts, who'll be with you this afternoon. Hello.
Hello, how's it going?
All right.
Are you a fan of going to the theatre to see the pictures?
I do. I don't get there as often as I like.
Yeah, I must admit I've found it a little bit more challenging time-wise to carve out the time to go and see a movie. But I have been a little bit lately, and I think maybe going less often than I used to actually makes it a little bit more special when you go to a picture theatre, particularly some of the ones that have been around for a really long time, because they just have such a sense of history to them.
Yes.
All the people that have been there before you and, you know, sometimes dating back to, you know, where you'd see a couple of features and a newsreel in the middle and all those kinds of things. So some work's been done by UniSA looking at what we know about the architecture of theatres in SA. So we're going to wind the clock back a little bit this afternoon and look at some of that. And we'll also be trying to answer the very important question, is it true that a wombat can run at 40 kilometres an hour or not? The scientific community has been in uproar about this.
As you say, very, very, very important question that needs to be answered. Get the radar gun out.
Yeah,
check
yeah,
the
that's
speed.
The way to do it. Yep.
Have a great show. Nikolai Bellhartz will be with you for this afternoon's program with that and much, much more. I'll be back tomorrow from noon with more Country Hour. Right now, it's news time.
To get started with the ABC Listen app, find the App Store on your phone. Search for ABC Listen, tap the pink ABC Listen icon, and download it. Congratulations, now you've got ABC Radio in your pocket.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.